From Democracy Now in Exile, this is the War and Peace Report.
What's happening now in Palestine is that Sharon's government is using the world's being busy with Afghanistan to continue his plans not to achieve peace in the Middle East.
Israel invades another West Bank town, shells a hospital, and kills 10 people overnight. We'll have a report from the director of the medical center that was shelled. Then we'll hear part two of the major anti-war address by Noam Chomsky, and we'll talk to Muslim liberation theologian Faridi Saq. Stay with us. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan is now the second. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli troops invaded the West Bank village of Beit Rima near Ramallah today as President Bush backed off from earlier demands that Israel immediately and permanently end its invasion and military occupation of Palestinian self-ruled towns in the West Bank. Israeli troops killed 10 Palestinians overnight, according to Israel Radio. Palestinian witnesses said the army fired without provocation, shelling a hospital among other buildings. In Bethlehem, the Archbishop Pietro Sambi from the Vatican and several bishops led thousands of Palestinians on a march to Manger Square, chanting, "Sharon, Sharon, hear, hear, Bethlehem is an Arab city." We go now to the director of the Beit Sahur Medical Center to talk about what has happened in Bethlehem.
The hospital in Bethlehem was shelled several times because most of the clashes are taking place in that area. Also, the University of Bethlehem have been shelled heavily. According to the directors of the university, over 100 pieces have fallen over the university compound, touching almost every room in it except of the library. The shelling is still continuing heavily in Bethlehem. There are dozens of casualties and numbers of people killed. At the clinic where I work in Beit Sahur, we had several bullets coming into the upper floor and also reaching the operating theater, which caused us to abandon the first floor and go down to the ground floor.
Is it possible for the Israeli army not to know that the medical center is a hospital?
Well, there is a big flag over the building with a red cross on it, and everyone knows the clinic in Beit Sahur. And everyone knows the hospital in Bethlehem, so I don't think they wouldn't know. But the shooting is mostly at random, and those bullets touch everything that lying ahead. We are calling on the people not to move on the streets because of stray bullets or the Israeli snipers. Minutes ago, we received that a man was shot in his own car in Bethlehem, just near the Bethlehem hospital. At the same time, what's much more worrying is what is happening in a village near Ramallah called Beit Rima. Until now, we hear the news from the local TV there that over 12 people from the village were killed and over 50 injured. There are over 1,000 soldiers entering the village, and it's almost a massacre there.
What do you think needs to be done now, and what about the U.S. role?
I think what is needed to be done now is an immediate stop of the Israeli invasion into the Palestinian cities, and that should be done immediately. We cannot wait longer. The American president and the American Congress must put harsh pressure on Israel to stop this invasion. It is going to be massacre-like circumstances. And only the United States and the United States president can stop the Israelis from continuing this madness.
And how does this fit into the war on Afghanistan, what Israel is doing?
Well, we have actually nothing to do with the war in Afghanistan. What's happening now in Palestine is that Sharon's government is using the world's being busy with Afghanistan to continue his plans not to achieve peace in the Middle East. As we all know, Sharon was opposing the Oslo Agreement from the very beginning, and he was opposing the withdrawal of the Israeli soldiers from the Palestinian cities. He is opposing the peaceful settlement, and what he is trying now is to push the Palestinians into a surrender-like situation where he can impose his conditions as he likes.
Dr. Majid Nassar, he's head of the Beit Sahur Medical Center right next to Bethlehem, one of the hospitals that has gotten shelled by the Israeli army. You're listening to the War and Peace Report.
Stop the war now. Good God, hear me sing. Don't put it off another day. Everybody says stop the war. Nah, 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 nah. Don't put it off another day. All we got to do is listen. If you ask them to fight again, what do you think they'd say? I'm not trying to be funny, I'm just trying to get my point across. War is world's enemy number one, and it's time that we called it off. Ow! Stop the war! Now! Good God, hear me say, don't put it off another day. Everybody singing, stop the war!
Stop the war now. Edwin Starr here on Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. This is Resistance Radio. Holy Cross Hospital in Washington, D.C. is now treating five D.C. postal workers for possible inhalation anthrax. The hospital says two more people with flu-like symptoms were admitted overnight. Two postal workers, Joseph Christine and Thomas Morris, died of what officials say was inhalation anthrax. Officials finally acknowledged yesterday they'd underestimated the danger that anthrax-contaminated letters pose to those who carry and sort the mail. Federal investigators still have no firm idea who's sending the envelopes of the deadly microbe through the mail or what's motivating the attacks, although they continue to operate under the assumption that there might be a link to the September 11th attacks. Investigators from the FBI, the U.S. Postal Service, and other agencies told the Washington Post that the mailings do not have the earmarks of a foreign terrorist operation and seem more likely to have come from a domestic source. Meanwhile, the Pentagon has approved the development of a genetically modified super anthrax bacteria to test U.S. defenses against biological attack, overriding concerns that the research could violate a 1972 germ warfare treaty. According to Milton Leitenberg, an expert on biological warfare at the University of Maryland, the Defense Department had intended to update its vaccine before the September 11th attacks, but postponed the project after the news was leaked to the press. We're going to continue our discussion about the so-called war on terrorism with Noam Chomsky, part two of the address we began yesterday. Noam Chomsky is a professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a world-renowned policy analyst, particularly a critic of U.S. foreign policy. He gave this anti-war address last week at MIT. Noam Chomsky.
What are the origins of the September 11th crimes? Here we have to make a distinction between two categories, which shouldn't be run together. One is the actual agents of the crime. The other is a kind of a reservoir of at least sympathy, sometimes support, that they appeal to even among people who very much oppose the criminals and the actions. And those are two different things. Well, with regard to the perpetrators, in a certain sense, we're not really clear. The United States either is unable or unwilling to provide any evidence, any meaningful evidence. There was a sort of a play a week or two ago when Tony Blair was set up to try to present it. I don't exactly know what the purpose of this was, maybe so that the U.S. could look as though it's holding back on some secret evidence that it can't reveal, or that Tony Blair could strike proper Churchillian poses or something or other. Whatever the PR reasons were, he gave a presentation which was, in serious circles, considered so absurd that it was barely even mentioned. So the Wall Street Journal, for example, one of the more serious papers, had a small story on page 12, I think, in which they pointed out that there isn't much evidence, and then they quoted some high U.S. official as saying it doesn't even matter whether there's any evidence because we're going to do it anyway. So why bother with the evidence? The more ideological press, like the New York Times and others, they had big front page headlines. But the Wall Street Journal reaction was reasonable, and if you look at the evidence, you can, so-called evidence, you can see why. But let's assume it's true. I mean, it was astonishing to me how weak the evidence was. I mean, I sort of thought you could do better than that without any intelligence service. In fact, remember, this was after weeks of the most intensive investigation in history of all the intelligence services of the Western world working overtime trying to put something together. And it was a prima facie, it was a very strong case even before you had anything. And it ended up about where it started, with a prima facie case. So let's assume it's true. So let's assume that, as you know, looked obvious the first day, still does, that the actual perpetrators come from the radical Islamic, here called fundamentalist, networks, of which the bin Laden network is undoubtedly a significant part. Whether they were involved or not, nobody knows. It doesn't really matter much. That's the background, those networks. Well, where do they come from? Well, we know all about that. Nobody knows about that better than the CIA because it helped organize them. And it nurtured them for a long time. They were brought together in the 1980s, actually, by the CIA and its associates elsewhere. Pakistan, Britain, France, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, China was involved. They may have even been involved a little bit earlier, maybe by 1978. The idea was to try to harass the Russians, the common enemy. According to President Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, the U.S. got involved in mid-1979. You remember, just to put the dates right, that Russia invaded Afghanistan in December 1979. Okay. According to Brzezinski, the U.S. support for the Mujahideen fighting against the government began in 6 months earlier, and he's very proud of that. He says, we drew the Russians into, in his words, an Afghan trap by supporting the Mujahideen, getting them to invade, getting into the trap. Then we could develop this terrific mercenary army, not a small one, maybe 100,000 men or so, bringing together the best killers they could find, who were radical Islamist fanatics from around North Africa, you know, Saudi Arabia, anywhere they can find them. They're often called the Afghanis, but many of them, like bin Laden, were not Afghans. You know, they were brought by the CIA and its friends elsewhere. Whether Brzezinski is telling the truth or not, I don't know. He may have been bragging. He's apparently very proud of it, knowing the consequences, incidentally. But maybe it's true. We'll know someday if the documents are ever released. Anyway, that's his perception. By January 1980, it's not even in doubt. The U.S. was organizing the Afghanis and this massive military force to try to cause the Russians maximal trouble. It was a legitimate thing for the Afghans to fight the Russian invasion, but the U.S. intervention was not helping the Afghans. In fact, it helped destroy the country and much more. The Afghanis, so-called, had their own... It did force the Russians to withdraw, finally, although many analysts believe it probably delayed their withdrawal because they were trying to get out already. Anyway, whatever. They did withdraw. Meanwhile, the terrorist forces that the CIA was organizing, arming, and training, carrying it, were pursuing their own agenda right away. It was no secret. One of their first acts was in 1981 when they assassinated the president of Egypt, who was one of the most enthusiastic of their creators. In 1983, one suicide bomber, who may or may not have been connected, it's pretty shadowy, nobody knows, but one suicide bomber drove the U.S. Army military out of Lebanon, and it continued. They have their own agenda. They're happy, the U.S. was happy to mobilize them to fight its cause. But meanwhile, they're doing their own thing, and they were very clear about it. After 1989, when the Russians had withdrawn, they simply turned elsewhere. Since then, they've been fighting in Chechnya and Western China and Bosnia, Kashmir, Southeast Asia, North Africa, all over the place. They're telling us just what they think. I mean, you know, the United States wants to silence the one free television channel in the Arab world because it's broadcasting a whole range of things from Powell over to Osama bin Laden. So the U.S. is now joining the repressive regimes of the Arab world to try to shut it up. But if you listen to it, if you listen to what bin Laden says, it's worth it. I mean, there are plenty of interviews. And there are plenty of interviews by leading Western reporters, if you don't want to listen to his own voice, Robert Fisk and others. And what he's been saying is pretty consistent for a long time. He's not the only one, though maybe he's the most eloquent. It's not only consistent over a long time, it's consistent with their actions. So there's every reason to take it seriously. Their prime enemy is the what they call the corrupt and oppressive, authoritarian, brutal regimes of the Arab world. And when they say that, they get quite a resonance in the region. They also want to defend, and they want to replace them by properly Islamist governments. That's where they lose the people of the region. But up till then, they're with them. From their point of view, even Saudi Arabia, the most extreme fundamentalist state in the world, I suppose, short of the Taliban, which is an offshoot, even that's not Islamist enough for them, has even more than that. Okay, at that point, they get very little support, but up until that point, they get plenty of support. Also, they want to defend Muslims elsewhere. They hate the Russians like poison, but as soon as the Russians pulled out of Afghanistan, they stopped carrying out terrorist acts in Russia, as they'd been doing with CIA backing before that in Russia, not just in Afghanistan. They did move over to Chechnya, but there they're defending Muslims against the Russian invasion. Same with all the other places I mentioned. From their point of view, they're defending Muslims against the infidels. And they're very clear about it, and that's what they've been doing. Why did they turn against the United States? Well, that had to do with what they call the U.S. invasion of Saudi Arabia. In 1990, the U.S. established permanent military bases in Saudi Arabia, which, from their point of view, is comparable to the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, except that Saudi Arabia is way more important. That's the home of the holiest sites of Islam. And that's when their activities turned against the United States. You recall that in 1993, they tried to blow up the World Trade Center. Got part of the way, but not the whole way, and that was only part of it. The plans were to blow up the UN building, the Holland and Lincoln Tunnels, the FBI building. I think there were others on the list. Well, they sort of got part way, but not all the way. The person who was jailed for that, finally, among the people who was jailed, was an Egyptian cleric who had been brought into the United States over the objections of the Immigration Service, thanks to the intervention of the CIA, which wanted to help out their friend. A couple of years later, he was blowing up the World Trade Center. And this has been going on all over. I'm not going to run through the list, but it's kind of, I mean, you can, you know, you might as well, if you want to understand it, it's consistent. It's a consistent picture. It's described in words. It's revealed in practice for 20 years. No reason not to take it seriously.
Professor Noam Chomsky giving a major anti-war address last week at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he is a professor of linguistics. We're going to continue with that speech after the break. If you want to order a video cassette copy for yourself, you can call 1-800-926-3921. That's 1-800-926-3921. You can also order it through Free Speech TV, which is where we're broadcasting on now over Dish Network Channel 9415. But you can go to their website at freespeech.org. You're listening to The War and Peace Report. We'll be back with Noam Chomsky in a minute.
Lift every voice and sing. Okay.
stony the road we trod.
Bitter the jasmine rod.
Felt in the
felt
days
in
when
the
hope.
Lift every voice and sing, Say Your Business, a live recording by Linda Tillery and the Cultural Heritage Choir. You are listening to the War and Peace Report with Anthony Sloan at the controls. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go back to Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at MIT, where he gave a major anti-war address last week.
What about the reservoir of support? Well, it's not hard to find out what that is. There's some discussion. One of the good things that's happened since September 11th is that some of the press and some discussion has begun to open up to some of these things. The best one, to my knowledge, is the Wall Street Journal, which right away began to run, within a couple of days, serious reports, searching serious reports on the reasons why people of the region, even if they hate bin Laden and despise everything he's doing, nevertheless support him in many ways, and even regard him as the conscience of Islam, as one said. Now, the Wall Street Journal and others, they're not surveying public opinion. They're surveying the opinion of their friends, bankers, professionals, international lawyers, businessmen tied to the United States, you know, people who they interview in McDonald's restaurants, which is an elegant restaurant. They're wearing fancy American clothes. That's the people they're interviewing because they want to find out what their attitudes are. And their attitudes are very explicit and very clear and in many ways consonant with the message of bin Laden and others. They are very angry at the United States because of its support of authoritarian and brutal regimes, its intervention to block any move towards democracy, its intervention to stop economic development, its policies of devastating the civilian society of Iraq while strengthening Saddam Hussein, and roughly. And when bin Laden gives those reasons, yeah, people recognize it and support it. Now, that's not the way people here like to think about it, at least educated liberal opinion. They like the following line, which has been all over the press, mostly from left liberals, incidentally. I've done a real study, but I think right-wing opinion has generally been more honest. But if you look at, say, at the New York Times, first op-ed they ran by Ronald Steele, a serious left liberal intellectual, he asked, why do they hate us? This is the same day, I think, that the Wall Street Journal was running the survey on why they hate us. So he says, they hate us because we champion a new world order of capitalism, individualism, secularism, and democracy that should be the norm everywhere. That's why they hate us. Same day, the Wall Street Journal is surveying the opinions of bankers, professionals, international lawyers, and saying, look, we hate you because you're blocking democracy, you're preventing economic development, you're supporting brutal regimes, terrorist regimes, and you're doing these horrible things in the region. A couple of days later, Anthony Lewis, way out on the left, explained that the terrorists seek only apocalyptic nihilism, nothing more, and nothing we do matters. The only consequence of our actions, he says, that could be harmful is that it makes it harder for Arabs to join in the coalition's anti-terrorism effort. But beyond that, everything we do is irrelevant. That's got the advantage of being sort of comforting, makes you feel good about yourself and how wonderful you are. It enables us to evade the consequences of our actions. It has a couple of defects. One is it's totally at variance with everything we know. And another defect is it's a perfect way to ensure that you escalate the cycle of violence. If you want to live with your head buried in the sand and pretend they hate us because they're opposed to globalization, that's why they killed Sadat 20 years ago and fought the Russians and, you know, tried to blow up the World Trade Center in 1993. And these are all people who are right in the midst of what the corporate globalization. But if you want to believe that, yeah, it's comforting. And it's a great way to make sure that violence escalates. That's tribal violence. You know, you did something to me, I'll do something worse to you. I don't care what the reasons are, and we just keep going that way. You know, that's a way to do it. Pretty much straight left liberal opinion. What are the policy options? Well, there are a number. A narrow policy option from the beginning was to follow the advice of really far out radicals like the Pope and Vatican immediately said, look, it's a horrible terrorist crime. In the case of a crime, you try to find the perpetrators, you bring them to justice, you try them, you don't kill innocent civilians. Like if somebody robs my house and I think the guy who did it is probably in a neighborhood across the street, I don't go out with an assault rifle and kill everybody in that neighborhood. You know, that's not the way you deal with a crime, whether it's a small crime like this one or a really massive one like the US terrorist war against Nicaragua and even worse ones and others in between. And there are plenty of precedents for that. In fact, I mentioned a precedent, Nicaragua. A lawful state, law-abiding state, which is why, presumably why we had to destroy it, which followed the right principles. Now, of course, it didn't get anywhere because it was running up against a power that wouldn't allow lawful procedures to be followed. But if the United States tried to pursue them, nobody would stop it. In fact, everyone would applaud. And there are plenty of other precedents. When the IRA set off bombs in London, which was a pretty serious business, Britain could... apart from the fact that it was unfeasible, let's put that aside, one possible response would have been to destroy Boston, which is the source of most of the financing, and of course to wipe out West Belfast. Well, you know, quite apart from feasibility, it would have been criminal idiocy. The way to deal with it was pretty much what they did. You know, find the perpetrators, bring them to trial, and look for the reasons, because these things don't come out of nowhere. You know, they come out of something. And whether it's a crime in the streets or a monstrous terrorist crime or anything else, there's reasons. And usually if you look at the reasons, there are, some of them are legitimate and ought to be addressed independently of the crime. They ought to be addressed because they're legitimate. And that's the way you deal with it. There's many such examples. But there are problems with that. One problem is that the United States does not recognize the jurisdiction of international institutions, so it can't go to them. It has rejected the jurisdiction of the World Court. It's refused to ratify the International Criminal Court. It's powerful enough to set up a new court if it wants, so that wouldn't stop anything. But there's a problem with any kind of a court, namely you need evidence. You go to any kind of court, you're going to need some kind of evidence, not Tony Blair talking on television. And that's very hard. It may be impossible to find. You know, it could be that the people who did it killed themselves. These are nobody knows this better than the CIA. These are decentralized, non-hierarchic networks. They follow a principle that's called leaderless resistance. That's the principle that's been developed by the Christian right terrorists in the United States. It's called leaderless resistance. You have small groups that do things, they don't talk to anybody else. There's a kind of a general background of assumptions, and then you do it. Actually, people in the anti-war movement are very familiar with this. We just call it affinity groups. If you're doing, if you assume correctly that whatever your group you're in is being penetrated by the FBI, when something serious is happening, you don't do it in a meeting. You do it with some people you know and trust, an affinity group. And then it doesn't get penetrated. That's one of the reasons why the FBI has never been able to figure out what's going on in any of the popular movements. And other intelligence agencies are the same. They can't, you know. That's leaderless resistance or affinity groups and decentralized networks are extremely hard to penetrate. And it's quite possible that they just don't know. When Osama bin Laden claims he wasn't involved, that's entirely possible. In fact, it's pretty hard to imagine how a guy in a cave in Afghanistan who doesn't even have a radio or a telephone could have planned a highly sophisticated operation like that. Chances are it's part of the background, you know, like other leaderless resistance terrorist groups, which means it's going to be extremely hard to find evidence. The U.S. doesn't want to present evidence because it wants to be able to do it to act without evidence. That's a crucial part of the reaction. You'll notice that the U.S. did not ask for Security Council authorization, which they probably could have gotten this time, not for pretty reasons, but because the other permanent members of the Security Council are also terrorist states. They are happy to join a coalition against what they call terror, namely in support of their own terror. Like Russia wasn't going to veto it, they love it. You know? So the U.S. probably could have gotten Security Council authorization, but it didn't want it. And it didn't want it because it follows a long-standing principle, which is not George Bush. It was explicit in the Clinton administration, articulated, and goes back much further. And that is that we have the right to act unilaterally. We don't want international authorization because we act unilaterally. We don't want it. We don't care about evidence. We don't care about negotiation. We don't care about treaties. We're the strongest guy around, you know, toughest thug on the block. We do what we want. Authorization is a bad thing and therefore must be avoided. There's even a name for it in the technical literature. It's called establishing credibility. You have to establish credibility. That's an important factor in many policies. It was the official reason given for the war in the Balkans and the most plausible reason. You want to know what credibility means? Ask your favorite mafia don. I'll explain to you what credibility means. And it's the same in international affairs, except, you know, it's talked about in universities. You do it with big words and that sort of thing. But it's basically the same principle. And it makes sense, and it usually works. Main historian who's written about this for the last several hundred years is Charles Tilly, his book called Coercion and Violence, and he points out that violence has been the leading principle of Europe for hundreds of years, and the reason is because it works. You know, it's very reasonable. It almost always works when you have an overwhelming predominance of violence and a culture of violence behind it. So therefore, it makes sense to follow it. Those are all problems in pursuing lawful paths. And if you did try to follow them, you'd really open some very dangerous doors. Like the U.S. is demanding that the Taliban hand over Osama bin Laden. And they're responding in a way which is regarded as totally absurd and outlandish in the West. Namely, they're saying, okay, but first give us some evidence. That is, in the West, that's considered ludicrous. It's a sign of their criminality. You know, how can they ask for evidence? I mean, if somebody asked us to hand someone over, we'd do it tomorrow. We wouldn't ask for any evidence. In fact, it's easy to prove that. We don't have to make up cases. So, for example, for the last several years, Haiti has been requesting the United States to extradite Emmanuel Constant, who's a major killer. He was one of the leading figures in the slaughter of maybe 4,000 or 5,000 people in the years in the mid-90s under the military junta, which incidentally was being not so tacitly supported by the Bush and the Clinton administrations, contrary to illusions. Anyway, he's a leading killer. They got plenty of evidence, no problem about evidence. He's already been brought to trial and sentenced in Haiti, and they're asking the United States to turn him over. Well, I mean, do your own research. See how much discussion there's been of that. Actually, Haiti renewed the request a couple of weeks ago. It wasn't even mentioned. Why should we turn over a convicted killer who was largely responsible for killing 4,000 or 5,000 people a couple of years ago? In fact, if we do turn him over, who knows what he'll say? Maybe he'll say that he was being funded by and helped by the CIA, which is probably true. We don't want to open that door. And he's not the only one. I mean, for the last about 15 years, Costa Rica, which is, you know, the democratic prize, has been trying to get the United States to hand over a John Hull, a U.S. landowner in Costa Rica, who they charge with terrorist crimes. He was using his land, they claim, with good evidence, as a base for the U.S. war against Nicaragua, which is not a controversial conclusion, remember. There's the World Court and the Security Council behind it. So they've been trying to get the United States to hand him over. Hear about that one? No. They did actually confiscate the land of another American landholder, John Hamilton, paid compensation, offered compensation. The U.S. refused, turned his land over to a national park, because his land was also being used as a base for the U.S. attack against Nicaragua. Costa Rica was punished for that one. They were punished for, by withholding aid. We don't accept that kind of insubordination from allies. And we can go on. If you open the door to questions about extradition, it leads in very unpleasant directions, so that can't be done. Well, what about reactions in Afghanistan? The initial proposal, the initial rhetoric, was for a massive assault, which would kill many people visibly, and also an attack on other countries of the region. Well, the Bush administration wisely backed off from that. They were being told by every foreign leader, you know, NATO, everyone else, every specialist, I suppose their own intelligence agencies, that would be the stupidest thing they could possibly do. It would simply be like opening recruiting offices for bin Laden all over the region. That's exactly what he wants, and it would be extremely harmful to their own interests. So they backed off that one. They're turning to what I described earlier, which is a kind of silent genocide. I already said what I think about it. I don't think anything has to be said. You can figure it out if you do the arithmetic. Is a sensible proposal, which is kind of on the verge of being considered, but it's been sensible all along, and is being asked, called for by expatriate Afghans and allegedly tribal leaders internally, is for a UN initiative, which would keep the Russians and the Americans out of it totally. These are the two countries that have practically wiped the country out in the last 20 years. They should be out of it. They should provide massive reparations, but that's their only role. A UN initiative to bring together elements within Afghanistan that would try to construct something from the wreckage. It's conceivable that that could work with plenty of support and no interference. If the U.S. insists on running it, you might as well quit. We have a historical record on that one. You'll notice that the name of this operation, remember, at first it was going to be a crusade, but they backed off that because PR agents told them that wouldn't work. And then it was going to be infinite justice, but the PR agents said, wait a minute, you're sounding like you're divinity, so that wouldn't work. And then it was changed to enduring freedom. We know what that means, but nobody has yet pointed out, fortunately, that there's an ambiguity there. To endure means to suffer. You know? And there are plenty of other people around the world who have endured what we call freedom. Again, fortunately, we have a very well-behaved, educated class, so nobody has yet pointed out this ambiguity. But if it's done, there'll be another problem to deal with. But if we can back off enough so that some more or less independent agency, maybe the UN, maybe credible NGOs, can take the lead in trying to reconstruct something from the wreckage with plenty of assistance, and we owe it to them, then maybe something would come out. Beyond that, there are other problems. We certainly want to reduce the level of terror, certainly not escalate it. There's one easy way to do that, and therefore it's never discussed, namely stop participating in it. That would automatically reduce the level of terror enormously, but that you can't discuss. Well, we ought to make it possible to discuss it. So that's one easy way to reduce the level of terror. Beyond that, we should rethink the kinds of policies, and Afghanistan's not the only one, in which we organize and train terrorist armies. That has effects. We're seeing some of the effects now. September 11th is one. Rethink it. Rethink the policies that are creating a reservoir of support. Exactly what the bankers and lawyers and so on are saying in places like Saudi Arabia and on the streets. It's much more bitter, as you can imagine. That's possible. You know, those policies aren't graven in stone. And furthermore, there are opportunities. It's hard to find many rays of light in the last couple of weeks, but one of them is that there is an increased openness. Lots of issues are open for discussion, even in elite circles, certainly among the general public, that were not a couple of weeks ago. That's dramatically the case. I mean, if a newspaper like, say, USA Today can run a very good article, serious article on life in the Gaza Strip, there's been a change. The things I mentioned in the Wall Street Journal, that's change. And among the general public, I think there's much more openness and willingness to think about things that were under the rug and so on. These are opportunities, and they should be used, at least by people who accept the goal of trying to reduce the level of violence and terror, including potential threats that are extremely severe and could make even September 11th pale into insignificance. Thanks.
Professor Noam Chomsky, speaking last week at his university, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. If you'd like to order a video cassette copy of the full speech, we played the first half of it yesterday, you can call 1-800-926-3921. That's 1-800-926-3921. You can also order it online at freespeech.org. Freespeech.org is Free Speech TV, and that's the nonprofit 24-hour channel on Dish Network 9415, where we broadcast every day, as well as on community radio stations around the country and on the internet at WBIX.org, as well as webactive.com. You are listening to Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. When we return, that was Noam Chomsky speaking at a major anti-war event in Boston. We're going to hear what people are doing around the country. Stay with us.
Oh, 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 oh. We all want. We all want. How many songs must we sing for justice? How many nights before we see the sun? Before we know that all we are is justice. Before we know that all we are is one. We are one. We are one. Planet rich with an abundance of food, yet tens of thousands die every day of starvation. A planet occupied by...
We are one here on Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. This is Free Speech Radio. Protests around the country and the world. About 2,000 Palestinians demonstrated today against Israel's incursions into the Palestinian-controlled areas of the West Bank. Afghanistan's opposition urged the United States and its allies today to work harder to prevent civilian casualties in the bombing of Afghanistan. Dr. Abdullah Abdullah, the opposition's foreign minister, said bombing raids against Taliban positions had inflicted more pain on a people who had already suffered under the rule of, quote, terrorists. Abdullah is on his way to meet commanders in the northeastern town of Khoja Bahawuddin and said the opposition Northern Alliance had received confirmed accounts of civilian casualties during the bombing raids. He said many Afghans had been killed or wounded in the southern city of Kandahar and the eastern city of Jalalabad in the strikes, which Washington and its allies launched earlier this month. Pakistani police fired tear gas to disperse thousands of demonstrators in Karachi after 35 Pakistani militants were killed by U.S. bombing in Kabul. In the United States, There have been teach-ins and rallies and protests around the country. About a week ago, we played the comments of listeners in Olympia, Washington, and heard about how they were organizing. Last night, here in New York, there was a teach-in at Riverside Church, tonight one at Hunter College. And every Wednesday night in New York, and this does happen around the country, women in black gather in front of the New York Public Library at 5:30 to protest the bombing of Afghanistan. Anyway, we put out the call over the last few weeks to ask what people were doing, and this is what some of you had to say.
This is Ann Goldstein, and I am calling from Boulder, Colorado, listening, of course, to KGNU. After your program about women in black last week, we decided to pull together women in black here in Boulder, and we actually had a silent vigil today from 5 to 6 o'clock, and there were 50 women at that, and that was actually just pulled together by word of mouth and email over 1 week. No particular organization sponsored it. It was just word of mouth about women in black. So we did want to thank you very much for your program, and people were really inspired by that. And we are going to continue to do a silent vigil every Wednesday from 5 to 6 in the middle of Boulder, Colorado.
My name is Thoreau, and not being a morning person, I am pleased to be listening to your second hour on KGNU in Colorado. What I'm doing is war tax resistance. I've been a war tax refuser since we went to war with Iraq. And in my mind these days, I see a conflict between people that are working for peace and continuing to pay for war. I don't know, it's a simple equation that just doesn't add up in my books. I think it's a powerful strategy. I haven't quite figured out how to best organize it. There's a huge fear factor, but in these days we just all have to do what we're afraid to do. The first thing our government did since this all happened was to freeze assets of people overseas and such, and that basically shows me how effective the strategy can be. What we're doing is freezing assets. And knowing that the country was founded on taxation without representation, that was one of the cores of the original revolution, I think that war tax resistance is perhaps the best chance to build community and to create a grassroots movement that can be quickly and profoundly effective.
This is Nancy Fisher from Santa Fe, New Mexico. I listen to KUNM in Albuquerque, 89.9. I'm a realtor, and the realtors in our community are backing an initiative for the whole community to band together and make this a safe place for everyone to live. We're organizing volunteers who will drive people if they're afraid of appearing in public. We're instituting training on how to ally with anyone who needs support in these difficult times. This training will be in the schools and in the community. We're enlisting businesses to put a symbol in their window that means all people are safe here. We believe that by making our community strong, this is something we can do in a positive direction during these terrible times.
I want to read the announcement of the fundraiser that I'm organizing. Women Read for RAWA. Women writers read their own and other women authors' writing. A fundraiser for the Revolutionary Association for the Women of Afghanistan. Help Afghani women refugees and the feminist organization fighting the Taliban in their war against women. Afghani women have been the first and the worst hit victims of the Taliban. They have also been the most courageous and determined opponents to toxic religious fanaticism.
Hey, my name is Danny. I'm listening in the Bronx to WFMU, I believe. And I'm a painter, and I've been focusing all my energy on painting images related to what's been going on with the World Trade Center. I was down as close as I could get, sort of painting the spectator's perspective. Also, I did a scene of the Union Square on the image of the George Washington sculpture statue with the peace symbols on it, and I'm hoping to have the possibility of exhibiting, maybe connecting with other artists who are for peace and for a more humane attitude towards the world, and possibly, you know, getting our perspective out a little bit through our art.
Hi, my name is Joan Johnson. I listen to KFAI. I live in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And my boyfriend and I and a lot of other friends have been doing a lot of different things. But the main thing my boyfriend and I decided to do was, first of all, make 10 signs, because we're part of a weekly vigil on Wednesday nights on the Lake Street Marshall Avenue Bridge, and to say no to the bombing. And we've been a part of a vigil for 2.5 years, and now we've moved into the current situation. And so we made new signs, and they were actually for his birthday. I asked him what he wanted for his birthday, and he said he wanted us to make 10 new posters. And so that's what we did. And then we also have a big black poster representing the darkness. And then each time we do an action or educate someone or write a letter or make a phone call, we put a candle on it with the theme of it's better to light a candle than to curse the darkness, because you can get feeling real despairing and powerless in light of the whole horrible situation in Afghanistan.
My name is Paul Dethebach. I listen to KPFA in the Bay Area. I am my activity is to oppose those on the left who are creating a moral equivalency of the United States bombing of Afghanistan, which is oriented towards military targets and the terrorists, trying to take the moral equivalency of that as the same as the actions of the terrorists against the Trade Center, where they specifically targeted civilians. There is no moral equivalency between the two, and it is my job to root out those who say so, and tell all that that the United States is fighting a righteous war against an evil enemy. Thank you.
My name is Greg Giorgio. I listen to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report on WRPI in Troy, serving the upstate New York, Eastern Region, Capital District area, and also parts of Western New England and Southern Vermont and Western Massachusetts. I helped organize and represent a group called the Good Friday Coalition, who has been out since the Friday after September 11th in preparation for what we were certain was going to be a violent response and retaliation. We are doing a peace vigil and informational picket every Friday morning at 11 a.m. in downtown Schenectady, New York, at the Armed Forces Recruiting Center. We started out roughly because of police interference early on. Our free speech rights were being violated, and we had to work hard to ensure that our First Amendment rights would be protected to protest the use of violent retaliation against anyone. And we're basically labor and social justice activists who are interested in preserving the message of nonviolence and a non-retaliatory solution to the world's problems, and recognize the class-conscious notion that these are the bosses' wars fought for the purposes of profit.
I'm in Santa Rosa, California. What I'm doing when I see people wearing red, white, and blue, when I see people in pain, I have a small card with a gray ribbon tied to it that I hand them. Wear gray ribbon as a call for reason and compassion in the midst of insanity. Wear gray for the courage to ask why. Wear gray that other innocents may not be sacrificed. Wear gray to speak for our precious civil rights. Gray is the color that lies between black and white, and there is not black and white in the decision to war. Gray is the color of ashes. Gray is the color of the dove. Tie gray to your red, white, and blue to speak for truth, American values, peace, justice, and civil rights.
Hi, my name is Penny. I am in Berkeley, California. What I'm doing in the war, I'm disabled and I'm an artist, and there's a an arts disability program in Berkeley, and my friends and I are having Make Your Own Flag workshops. It actually wasn't my idea, but a friend of mine went to one and brought the idea back. And many of us are putting our flags on our wheelchairs. And others are in the window or on doors. And we've had materials donated, and we've just also gone through our own supplies and donated. And it's really been an affirming thing. It was a very healing process to be doing it and talking about it with other people, to come up with our ideas about what we think, and to see other people's expressing their ideas all in art.
I'm a Vietnam veteran, originally was a conscientious objector, which was rejected by the U.S. government, so I spent 2 years as a war resister, actually in uniform. I believe that war today is obsolete. I mean, all the anthrax stuff that's going on, I mean, we have to believe in human nature around the world, whatever nationality it is. I'm listening in Oakland, California to KPFA.
David Reardon.
And you've been listening to the voices of listeners and viewers around the country who are talking about what they're doing in their own communities. And you, too, can call us at 212-209-2999 and let us know what you're doing in this time of war. I said earlier in the program that Farid Isaac would be with us. Well, he is going to join us tomorrow. He's author of the book Quran, Liberation, and Pluralism, an Islamic perspective of interreligious solidarity against oppression. He is a professor, senior lecturer in religion at the University of the Western Cape, South Africa, internationally known scholar and activist, was a member of the ANC in South Africa, and we'll talk about Pakistan, South Africa, and liberation on our program tomorrow. As has happened quite often in this city, this very troubled city, as he attempted to get down here, it took him about an hour and a half, what normally would have been a 20-minute ride. Here at the, just a block from where we are, the roadblock still stands. There are Humvees, there are National Guard and police and sheriffs and state police. We are, again, broadcasting just blocks from Ground Zero as the emergency workers, the evacuation crews, continue to dig through the rubble as those same kinds of people, emergency crews, dig through the rubble of Afghanistan. That does it for the program. Again, if you'd like to order the video cassette of the speech of Noam Chomsky or Howard Zinn, you can call 1-800-926-3921. That's 1-800-926-3921, or go to the website, freespeech.org. That's www.freespeech.org, and you can order it there. Democracy Now in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy, with help from Janice K. Bryant, and we welcome her to our exiled studios, another producer in exile. Anthony Sloan is our technical director, Errol Maitland at the helm at www.wbix.org. Thanks to Amy Pomerleau at KPFA, and Free Speech Radio news producer Aaron Glantz, and especially here at Downtown Community Television to John Alpert and Keiko Sunu, a very gracious thank you. We are broadcasting just blocks from the World Trade Center in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
Une fois que ta santé relance, tu t'allonges sur ton dos.
Yeah.
Tu es le temps. Tu tournes que des brillants. Tu t'enfonces dans ta
information.
information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. 6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level.
We have more breaking news. We have recently confirmed report that at 2:35 this afternoon, Governor Franklin died from a gunshot wound to the head. The wound was apparently self-inflicted. In the aftermath of this, reports have surfaced all over the internet about the truth to this whole story that the mainstream media has refused to report.
That's right. You know, I really feel that it's time, personally, that we start to take the media into our own hands and become the media ourselves. We need to start opening our own stations. In fact, I've heard there's a lot of stations opening up all around the country.
Freeze that man down!
The FBI is busting in the door!
Shut that thing out! Get out! Get out! Get out on the ground!